Allison.
Not many people can.
How are y'all doing? Good?
It's awesome.
Glad it finally feels like fall out there?
Yes.
Good, me too. Well, a lot of you I know, but some of you I haven't gotten to meet yet. So I'm Nicole Tabor, and I work with Fostering Together here at North Point Ministries, specifically with our North Point campus and the Browns Bridge campus. So any Alpharetta coming families? Woohoo! Awesome. Well, I just want to welcome everybody. We're so glad that you decided to come here today. We really feel like this day is going to be super beneficial for you guys. I just want to go through a few housekeeping items. Hopefully you all saw we have coffee, water, snacks. Feel free to get up during our time in this room. We're only going to be in here for about an hour and 15 minutes or so, and then we're going to go to lunch. So you guys are going to have the privilege of hearing from Lila Bradley, and if any of you have been around for a while, you've probably gotten to hear her, and she is just full of knowledge, so we're excited that you're here for that. And then at the end of the day, we're going to do something called the Cost of Poverty Experience, which is a role play. So after lunch, you'll get to do that, and our team, half of our team did that about a year ago and really got a lot out of it. So I think that you guys will enjoy it. When we got done with it, we said we have to bring that here to one of our continuing education events. Across the hall and then down the hall a little ways in another one of the classrooms are bathrooms. So they're not super visible, but if you go into the classroom, you'll see along the back wall there's a restroom if you need to get up and do that. So I'm going to pray for us, and then we're going to do a little opening activity. Again, for those of you that know Fostering Together, we just love community is at the heart of what we do, and so we really want you to not only get training and get hours today, but also get to know some people around you, some people that maybe are in the same situation as you, or foster teenagers, or take in newborns, you know, just to have that connection. So we hope that at the end of the day, hopefully you've exchanged some cell phone numbers or email addresses with people, because we really just want you to feel supported and not feel isolated where you are in your fostering journey. So let me pray for us, and then I will explain our little activity. Dear God, thank you so much for this day. Thank you so much for the beautiful weather. We just are so appreciative of who you are and the different seasons, Lord. It's just such a good reminder that you care about the details of each and every one of our lives, God. I just thank you for every person in this room and just for the choice that they've made to be involved in foster care, Lord, and just investing in lives of these kiddos. So I just pray, Lord, that today would be an awesome day, that they would learn a lot and meet other people, God, and just thank you so much for each and every one of them here. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. All right, so for the introverts in the room, I apologize in advance. But we're going to do a little bingo activity, so you're going to get up. Everybody have a bingo sheet and pen. So you're going to go around and get signatures. One person can sign one box. Like, they can't sign multiple boxes on your sheet, if that makes sense. So the first person to get two lines of bingo, across, diagonal, straight up and down, say bingo if you want to, but then come up here. So the first two people to get that, we have a little prize for you. All right, everybody ready for that? Feeling good? Excited? The extroverts are like, yes! All right, so everybody get up. We're going to do that for the next 10 minutes or so.
Thank you.
to the bingo.
Yes, so if you, she will be able to help you with the laptop.
So we're very privileged to have her here today. And what we're going to do as it relates to Q&A is this phone number, if you just save it in your contacts as text too, like grab it now, stick it in your phone, you'll be able to get to it easily. If you have questions while she's talking, go ahead and type the question in to that text number. They're going to be coming to our computer. We'll be able to find some common themes and make sure that we get the most prevalent questions back on the airwaves toward the end of Lila's time. And if you have individual questions, ones that are super important to you, just know that Lila loves to be of support to this ministry. She's left her business cards on the back table. You can take one of those. You're also going to get a handout of her materials that they're handing out right now to be able to take notes while she's talking. So, and I have a feeling, knowing Lila, that she'll hang around a minute or two after she talks to you and when we're heading to lunch. So if you have something burning that doesn't get on the airwaves, she's really gracious that way. So anyway, if you guys would give her a hand as she steps up here, Lila. thank you for having me. I love talking to foster parents and working with foster parents. So just, you know, tell you a little bit about myself, and also my law partner, Lynn Goldman, often does these talks with me, but she wasn't available this weekend. So if you get the handout, you'll have both of our names and contact information. I started my legal career as a corporate lawyer, and then I had three kids and stayed home with them, and of course that never means staying home, and so I, you know, I chaired every committee at the church and every committee at the PTA, and when I realized I wanted to get and needed to get back into some paid employment, I went looking for a job that involved children, and I found there's a pro bono organization called Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation, and they were starting a new program to use volunteer attorneys in the juvenile court to represent foster children. And so I went to the executive director and I interviewed and I said, look, I don't know anything about this area of law, but I can run a program and I will learn this area of law. And he said, thank you very much, but we've actually offered the job to a lawyer who has a lot of experience in this area of law. Her name is Lynn Goldman. And then Lynn Goldman turned the job down, thankfully for me. So I got the job to run the program, and then Lynn came along and helped me learn the law, and we've been working together ever since. And so we spent about 10 years representing foster children in Fulton County and a little bit in DeKalb County. We then, you know, moved on into private practice and stayed together where we do adoption law and also assisted reproduction, surrogacy, and all the things to, you know, the legal side of helping people have families who aren't able to conceive or carry children on their own. But frankly, this child welfare law is where our hearts are. And so that's why, please know, we will always take your phone calls and answer your emails and try to help you work through the legal side or the policy side of what's going on with your kids' cases. And then if you're one of those few, you know, it's not the majority of the cases, but one of those few cases that moves on to adoption by the foster parents, we do that too. So I want to know a little bit about who y'all are. So I want to know how many different counties we're dealing with. So how many people are fostering kids who are with Fulton County? What about DeKalb and Gwinnett, Cobb, Forsyth, Paulding, Cherokee, and they're about to get a new juvenile court judge in Cherokee. Clayton, anybody from the south side? Douglas County? Carroll County? Okay, Jefferson County? Is that what you said? Okay. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. Okay, great. So how many of y'all are with private child placing agencies? And how many of you are contracting directly with DFACs? Okay, so about half and half. That's interesting. How many people have been fostering less than 3 years? A lot. How many have been fostering more than 5 years? More than 10 years? Okay. And how many of you have children under the age of 5 in your home? How many of you have children over the age of 12? Over the age of 14? One fostering teenagers, okay. And then in terms of the way that your placements have turned out, how many of you have been through a disruption where things were going badly enough that you had either the child asked to be removed or you asked for the child to be moved? A few people. How many of you have seen the children you were fostering go to permanent custody or at least placement with a relative? Okay, just a few, interesting. How many have fostered children who have been reunified with their biological parents? Okay, and what about, have any of you adopted children? Almost. Okay. All right. And have any of you fostered all the way to emancipation, a child who aged out of care? Okay. All right.
So what I'm going to try to do today is zip through the law relating to foster care. And because it's a lot and it's important, but if you're a fan of the Pirates of the Caribbean movie like I am, think about it's really only guidelines. Okay? So I've given you a citation to Georgia's Juvenile Code where you can find it and read the law for yourself. The code, we completely revamped the code about, I think it's about 10 years now. And it was an amazing effort, and it took years and years to rewrite that code. And it was the participation by academics and DFACS people and lawyers, and it was an amazing effort, and it improved things a lot, but it didn't solve the problems, because that's just not what the law does. But we'll talk about what the law says and how it can, how it impacts your kids and your, you know, the way that you help those children and those families through the system. I've also given you a link to Georgia's DFACS policy. Because one of the things you'll hear a lot about, you'll hear a lot from the case managers from time to time is, well, that's against policy. And then sometimes they'll say that's against the law, and it's actually policy that they're talking about, because a lot of times people don't understand the difference between policy and law. So just, you know, the basics are, the law are the rules that were adopted and approved by our legislature and are then interpreted and applied by our courts. And then when cases go up on appeal, the appellate courts will further clarify and add to the statutory law. Policy is what our agency, our state agency, DFACS, puts in place to describe the way they operate, you know, the rules by which they bring these children into care for them while they're in the system, and then try to move them to a permanent, so, you know, permanent situation, permanent home, either back with family or with you know, with an adoptive home or whatever the best thing is for the kids. But still, whether it's law or policy, it really is just guidelines. Ultimately, you know, decisions are made balancing first and foremost the child's need and entitlement to safety and well-being, the parents' right to the care and custody of their children, and the, you know, sometimes those things don't line up, and then the courts have to figure out what to do with those kids, and it's hard, it's confusing. The law and policy that works as the child is brought into the system, that's really beyond the scope of this talk. But, you know, you might already know from some of your personal, you know, interaction with these kids, sometimes it's done by the book and sometimes not. And that kid, the way things happened before that kid came into care, is going to have an ongoing impact on the case, and that can be confusing sometimes. So just to be aware of that. So when y'all get the kids, you know, there's already a court case going on because the state, DFACS, has to get court permission before it takes a child away from a family. And when it goes to the judge to get permission to take that child away from the family, a juvenile court case commences to oversee everything that the state agency is doing as it cares for the child and tries to get the child out of state custody. So let's talk about who's in the courtroom. These cases are multi-party cases, and so all of the parties to the case, and that's kind of a key term, party.
the case should be in the courtroom. So that's the state, DFACS, the parents, you know, or other legal custodians. So sometimes children are brought into care out of the custody, say, of a grandparent or a grandparent who had guardianship. So whoever the child got removed from is a party to the case, as well as the parents. And the child is a party to the case. That was one of the things that we clarified with the rewrite of the juvenile code, is that the child is a party to his or her own case. And that's really key, I think. The judge, of course, sits up front. One of the key things to remember is that nobody gets to talk to the judge outside of the presence of the other parties in the case. And most judges are good at obeying that rule, not all. The SAG, which is such an unfortunate acronym, but it stands for the Special Assistant Attorney General who represents DFACS. It's the DFACS lawyer. You know, our Attorney General is an elected position. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the name of the current AG because it has changed, you know, recently. But the AG has a whole staff of attorneys who work for that office. But for DFACS cases, they appoint those cases out to attorneys in private practice. So there are attorneys in all the regions of the state who accept this work on an hourly basis. And so they sometimes, in some of the smaller communities especially, you know, they have a private practice where they're doing other kinds of law, usually family law, divorces, child custody and such, and then they're also doing DFACS cases. In the larger jurisdictions, they tend to be more specialized and they'll only do the DFACS work. It just depends. The child attorney. So under the code, the child has a right to an attorney. And I think in most of the metro counties, that rule is being followed. Not always. CASA, you know, is a volunteer program where people volunteer, get training, and then are appointed as court-appointed special advocates to represent the best interest of the child. Then the guardian ad litem, or GAL, or GAL, is, again, someone who's appointed to represent the child's best interest. So child attorney, CASA, and guardian ad litem, those roles overlap, and it can be confusing sometimes to figure out what they're who that person is and what their responsibilities are. So in some counties, it'll be an attorney guardian ad litem. In some counties, it'll be an attorney acting as an attorney and then a CASA acting as guardian ad litem. In some counties, you'll have all three. In Fulton County, you have all three. You've got an attorney on every case. If the case is particularly difficult, you have a guardian ad litem, and then you have a CASA. If they have enough volunteers, they try to get the CASAs on most of the cases. So you could have all three, or you could have one person, you know, on two of those roles. The parent attorney. The parents are entitled to legal counsel, and if they cannot afford legal counsel, the court is obligated to appoint them with counsel and pay for it. Different courts handle that differently. My experience in Fulton County is that if somebody just says, I need a lawyer, they give a million. In some of the other counties, if somebody says, I need a lawyer, they say, fill out this financial affidavit, and we're going to evaluate whether you meet the poverty guidelines to be appointed an attorney to represent you. So a little bit different, but they are entitled to a lawyer. And then the foster parent. I would hope that you would be in the courtroom whenever you are able to. I know your lives are very busy. You're not a party to the case, though, and that can be difficult sometimes. So how many of y'all have been to at least one court hearing in your cases? How many of you go every time you possibly can? Okay, all right. How many of you are discouraged by your agency or your case manager or somebody from going to court? I will tell you, that's a hot button issue with me. I feel very strongly that one of the, I mean, there's so many, so much of what you do, of course, is vital to this child. But I believe that going to court is one of the most vital parts of your role. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we go through. So let's talk about the child in the courtroom. So how many of you, do your children go to some of their court hearings? Okay, do any of you have children that go to every court hearing? Okay. Do you have any children, let's say, over the age of 5 who never go to court? Okay. Under the law, the child is entitled to go to court and is essentially mandated to be in court unless the court excuses them from attendance. Now, there are very valid reasons to excuse a child from court. You know, a child who is an infant is not going, you know, the child in and of him or herself is not perhaps going to derive value from going to court, although I will suggest to you that the case will have, that there will be a positive impact on the case if the child is in court. Because these judges and lawyers, they have a lot of cases that they see. And I'm sorry to say, they blend together. And when you bring a real, live, human child into that courtroom, it helps them to distinguish that child's case. Okay? It's very valid to excuse a child from court when the child has to go to school, because we know that court hearings can, you know, you've got to count on it taking at least half the day, if not all day. And it's boring and it's frustrating, and the courtroom hallways are not set up for little kids. But again, you know, I want you to think about when there could be value to the case for your child to be there, and to think about advocating for that. The attorneys who represent the children are carrying a high caseload, and they are supposed to see those kids and talk to those kids on a regular basis. But their kids are scattered around the state. Not just the metro area, but around the state. And it's hard to do. It's hard to be in court, prepare your cases, do the work you need to do, and get out to see every kid on your caseload. So sometimes the lawyers in your case will ask that the child be present so the lawyer can see the child and talk to him. So I encourage you to cooperate with that and help facilitate that whenever possible. The other reason for the child to be there is hopefully their parents will be there. And so that could be an opportunity for more contact with the parents. That can also be a negative. I totally recognize that. And again, it's part of that evaluation of whether the child should be excused that time around. But in a reunification case, I generally believe that the more contact between the child and the parent, the better. And even if it's sitting in the hallway, it also gives you a chance to see that interaction, perhaps. But if you believe that it's not in the child's best interest to go to court, then your position should be heard by the child's attorney, by the guardian ad litem, and by DFACS, so that they can take that into account. Just know that they might not, reasonable minds can differ on that decision. And these are the factors that the parties are wrestling with as they try to decide whether to bring the child. So let's talk about the judge. And I put this in red because people think about the judge as being, you know, all powerful. They sit up behind a bench and wear a black robe, and you have to talk politely to them. And they do. They have a lot of power. I mean, it is an amazing power to be able to take a child away from a family. That's huge. They get to decide whether to give that child, when they take the child away, they get to decide whether to give the child to another family member or to the state, and then they get to decide when to return that child to the parents, or perhaps when to terminate the parental rights. They decide what kind of visitation to order, and they hold DFACs to task if they feel like, based on the evidence, that the department is not making the efforts that the law calls for to care for the child and reunify the child with the family. But they are also extremely limited in their power. And so I want you to keep that in mind, because when you see a case that's not going the way you think it ought to, it's dragging on too long, or you know, they're continuing visits even in the face of a parent who just is not doing the work that you think the parent should be doing, or whatever. Once the judge gives the child to the state custody, to DFACs, then the judge's ability to get into the day-to-day care for that child is extremely limited. They really can't make specific orders about how that child is to be cared for. They cannot say, place that child with that foster parent over there, or that agency over there, or in that location. All they can really do is say, I don't think this placement is right, but they can't control that. And it's a difficult place to be in. They cannot order services for the child that the state cannot afford, or that don't exist, frankly. You probably all know by now, if you've been fostering for any length of time, that there aren't enough services to go around, especially services of high quality. And so the judge can't fix that. Their only option, when I said that they hold DFACs to task, but the only thing they can do when they think DFACs is not doing their job is make a finding that DFACs has failed to use reasonable efforts to reunify the child and family. And in the end, you know, that's a big system kind of a remedy. It doesn't have a direct impact on that case. So there's no teeth in that law. And then while the judge is the one who gets to make the decision of whether to terminate parental rights, the judge cannot initiate that. And so the judge has to sit back and wait until someone, you know, one essentially DFACs asks, petitions for termination. So if you've got a case that's dragging on forever and you think, why hasn't the judge terminated rights? Well, it's possibly because DFACs hasn't asked them yet, hasn't filed that petition. Briefly to talk about evidence and what's admissible in court, because that's one of the things that can be very frustrating as you go to court, or at least as you hear about what's going on in court, and you think, why didn't they tell this, that, or the other to the judge? Why didn't that information come into court? And it could be because it's not admissible evidence. You know, a lot of what you know about this case might come from transporters. You know, they can be great sources of information, but I want you to think about how reliable are they really, and how much of what you are getting is opinion versus, you know, actual observable fact. In an informal review, because the kinds of cases that you that are held in court can be formal or informal. In an informal review, they can talk about things that are not actual observable factual evidence. But for a decision to be made, there has to be evidence in court. And that, you know, that again, it's narrow. It's not someone's opinion so much as it is, you know, what did we observe? What will I testify to about what happened in this case? And so that can be difficult. Ultimately, the court's decisions are based on best interest. So I've given you the list of 20 factors that our Georgia Juvenile Code specifies are to be taken into account for best interest. As you read through those, it'll all make sense to you, and then you get to number 20 and it says any other relevant factor. And making a decision on the best interest of the child is complicated. And again, you probably already know that. And these children, a lot of times, there aren't best options for these children. You know, there are options, each of which has strong points for the kids and has negative points for the kids. And so, again, it's complicated. The reasonable efforts, you'll hear a lot about, how many of you have heard that term before? Reasonable efforts. Parents are supposed to make reasonable efforts. If you go to court, you'll hear it a lot. And so I've given you the code citations and the policy citations. But essentially, you know, the law says when you take a child away from the family, the state has to make reasonable efforts to reunify that child with the family and then make reasonable efforts to gain permanency for that child. And so it feels very vague. And again, it is also about all these complicating factors. It's supposed to hold the state agency to a level of attention that would prevent children from just languishing in foster care. This law was put into place, you know, probably, I guess about 25 years ago, you know, at a time when children would come into foster care and there was no law that said you had to get them back out. And so they would just grow up in foster care. You've probably heard stories like that. The diligent search for relatives is another key part of our law, and it's one that I think is very important for you as the caretakers of these children to be aware of and to know that you can help with. You know, the law requires the department to conduct a diligent search for relatives frankly, they're supposed to ask before the child comes into care. They're supposed to conduct the search and turn in a court report on that search immediately after the child comes into care, and then they have an ongoing obligation to continue the search for these relatives. And the reason is because we believe as a society that children are going to be better off if they can stay within their family of origin safely. But we've got to find that family of origin. So many times these kids, part of the reason their family has deteriorated in a way, their immediate family has deteriorated so that the family can't take care of them, is related to alienation from an extended family. And so if you can find that extended family, you might be able to find fit and willing relatives. So those are key terms. Fit, you know, actually able to safely care for the child, and willing to care for the child. And so that's an ongoing obligation. The diligent search is something that some case managers are very good at, and some are not, and then there's lots in the middle. You know, I'll tell you, it breaks my heart when you see, you know, when you look at a kid's case that's been in care for 2 years, 2-3 years, you look back at the diligent search and it's just blank. It says, mother did not report any relatives. And then you talk to the kid, and the kid tells you, oh yeah, there was a grandmother, and I used to go see my auntie, and none of that's on the diligent search. And so that is information that if you've got a verbal child in your home, you may start hearing those stories. I'm not telling you to sit down and pump this child for information, but as you get to know this child, if you start hearing about relatives, you need to give that information to DFACS and to the child attorney so that they can incorporate that into the diligent search. You know, if you happen to be the detective sort, which some of you probably are, and you're probably Facebooking, you know, Facebook stalking the families, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're discovering information about the families that you think DFACS doesn't have, give it to DFACS and give it to the child attorney to help them with this diligent search. Because if there are fit and willing relatives, then that's where the child probably needs to be. If there are relatives who are not fit or willing, it is better to get that information into the case early on and get that box checked, because it will delay permanency at the end if they find out there's a grandmother out there that they never looked into. And maybe they never looked into her because somebody said, oh, she doesn't want this kid. Or somebody said, well, you know, she uses drugs too. But they never checked it out. And that's going to delay permanency in the end. And so if you can help get this information to DFACS on the front end, that's going to help your kids. So talking briefly about the initial timelines after removal, again, remembering, you know, the timelines are in the law, they're reflected in the policy, but they're really just guidelines, because there's all different kinds of ways that these timelines can get off track. But there's a preliminary protective hearing immediately after the child is removed from the family. If the judge determines at that preliminary hearing that there's probable cause to keep the child in care, the department is supposed to file a petition within 5 days. That part of the timeline typically is pretty well adhered to. Then it gets off track. You're supposed to have an adjudication hearing. That's an evidentiary hearing where the department says, here's our evidence of why this child is dependent and should be, you know, should stay in foster care. Parents come in with their lawyers and say, no, here's my evidence to contradict the department's evidence. Here's my cross-examination of the department's witnesses to show that they aren't telling the whole truth. And, you know, we're asking for return of the child. That adjudicatory hearing, however, I would say 50-50 of whether it's going to happen in 10 days. It has to be scheduled within 10 days, but then people ask for continuances in order to prepare their case, and the judge usually grants it. And sometimes if one or both of the parents have disappeared, which often will happen because this child came into care usually at a moment of crisis or just, you know, out of a chaotic situation, and those parents may be hard to find. Case is going to get continued until they can be found and brought in court. Maybe they show up in court and they haven't met with their lawyer yet. Case is going to get continued until they've had a chance to meet with their lawyer. So that's one of the first places the case will get off track. DFACS is supposed to develop the case plan and submit it within 30 days, but they can't develop the case plan unless they got the parent sitting down with them. So again, if they can't get the parent engaged in that early time frame, which is often the case, the case plan is going to get delayed. The dispositional hearing, you know, is where the judge finally says, okay, the disposition is to keep this child in foster care or to send him to a relative. It's supposed to happen, you know, 30 days after adjudication, but again, if adjudication's already way out, disposition's going to be way out, just different ways that can happen. And then while the child is in foster care, there will be periodic review hearings and then permanency hearings. And so these are where, under the code that was adopted in the last 10 years, the timelines were stepped up. And I think it has had a good impact. It hasn't been revolutionary. But it does, the more often you're in court, as much as a pain as it can be to go to court for your families and for the kids and for the DFACS workers, we all operate on deadlines, right? And so if you know you've got a court hearing coming as a DFACS worker, then you're going to make sure you see the kid, or you're going to try to make sure you see the kid, you know, check in on his education, check in on his services so that you can report it to court. So I'm sure y'all have seen that nothing happens until right before court, and then a lot happens. While that's unfortunate, it's life, and that's why we increased the number of court hearings in the code revision. A permanency plan hearing is supposed to be just a really seriously ramped up review hearing where the party parties all dig into that question of the permanency plan. Is it going to be, you know, reunification? Are we still working towards reunification? Or do we need to add a possible termination and adoption plan to this case? Again, some courts are better than others at really digging in to these permanency hearings. But if you have to make a decision, if you can't get to all the court hearings, the permanency hearings are the ones you want to go to. And hoping that that's where they're really going to have a serious conversation. Visitation. The code specifically addresses visitation. And I don't know how much of an impact this has really had on these cases. So I'm curious, how many of you have kids in your home who are visiting with their parents without supervision? Okay. It's still not very many. The code says that the default should be unsupervised visitation. How many of y'all were aware of that? The code says that the default position on visitation should be unsupervised, and that then the department should have to make argument and present evidence as to why supervision is required. And I don't think that has, I don't think the code has had the impact that we had hoped it would. Recognizing completely that when a child is removed from someone who is in, you know, deep addiction and not properly caring for young children, those visits should be supervised. Absolutely. But that's an easy argument to make to the court to get your supervision. But when you've got a 10-year-old who came into care because mom was depressed and had a filthy house and was not getting the children to school, what's the risk to that child from an unsupervised visit? So that needs to be discussed. That needs to be discussed because the best path to reunification is going to be to maintain that parent-child relationship as well as we can while the child's in care. And requiring visits to be in the DFAC's office with a case manager sitting in the room doesn't really facilitate that relationship very well. So I want y'all to think about that and maybe ask that question. If you've got a case where you think the supervision is possibly unnecessary, you know, ask that question to the child attorney or to the caseworker and see if you could have an impact on that. Case plans, do any of y'all get to see the case plans?
No.
No, and that's frankly appropriate. I mean, it's really not your business, okay? And then that's hard to acknowledge, but it's not. The case plan should be a very personal thing to those parents. It has a lot of confidential information in it. You're going to be able to find out what the goals of the case plan are if you go to court or go to the citizen review panel. How many of you have been to a citizen review panel? Okay. Frankly, if you want to see the case plan, that's where you'll see it. Is at the citizen review panel. In my experience, they tend to hand those things around. The limitations of the case plan, of course, they're form documents. You know, the drop-down menus, and they end up being a little bit cookie-cutter. But in the end, it's the case plan that should guide the case to reunification or to an alternate permanency plan for that child. And so, so I know you're going to want to know what those goals are and how the parents are doing as they make progress to those goals. And that's what the review hearings are about. You know, okay, mom, this child came into care because you had an untreated addiction to opioids. How many of you are in cases with involving opioid addiction? It's interesting. I would have thought there would be more.
So what have you done? You know, are you, you know, have you engaged in treatment? Have you got to get into treatment, you've got to have an assessment, then a recommendation, and you got to follow those recommendations. It's actually complicated and hard to get into treatment. And Deepak is supposed to be helping her with that. And she's an addict. And so, you know, making those changes in her life are very difficult. The case plan is supposed to remind everybody. Deepak makes the referrals. Mom or dad goes to the appointment. The report comes back recommending inpatient or outpatient treatment. Then Deepak helps identify the inpatient or outpatient treatment, and mom actually goes. The case plan is supposed to help everybody remember that. The case plan then also documents the permanency plan for this child that the court has approved. And so the first choice for permanency for all these kids by law is reunification. The only time under the law that a case can go straight to non-reunification is if there are aggravated circumstances. So have any of y'all fostered children who came in with severe injuries? Okay. So as you can see just by this little sampling, that is not the norm. You know, severe injury is actually in the grand scheme of things, it's actually a pretty significant minority of the cases. Without severe injury that is clearly, demonstrably caused by the parents, the case is going to go to reunification first. Even if the moms had other terminations, even if everybody can look at this case and say, there's no way this mom's ever going to get it together. The dad's gone, or they're still together and there's terrible domestic violence. There's no way. We're still called on to try. But you can do concurrent case plans. How many of y'all are aware that there are concurrent plans in your cases? So, you know, that's a contradiction, right? It means you're planning for reunification and planning for non-reunification at the same time. So what kind of message is that sending to the family? You know, how much does the mother trust that she's actually going to be able to do the work and get her kids back if the department's also at the same time planning for non-reunification? So it's hard. It's supposed to speed up the is that my time left, or is that the time
That's
of day?
That's the time.
Of day.
Correct.
So how much time do I have left?
The next 15 minutes we're going to do the Q&A.
Okay, then let me zip through.
Yeah,
all right, so permanency plans, placement changes. We talked a little bit about the department can change that child's placement whenever they want to, but they have to notify everybody. So if you have an argument with that, you have the right to go into court and make your voice heard. And then finally, just foster parents in court. As I said, you're not a party to this case, but under the juvenile code and under the Foster Parent Bill of Rights, which is still in our code, even though people don't talk about it as much as they used to, you have the right to be heard. You don't have the right to cross-examine other witnesses. You don't have the right to gain confidential information about the parents, but you have the right to be heard, and that's really key. And then finally, adoption. As Leslie said, I was very involved in the revision of our adoption code. You may have read some of the press about it in the last couple of years. It did some good things. One of the things I will say that the good thing is that the state legislator who sponsored that adoption code, rewrite Burt Reeves, I think some of you are from Cobb County, might be your, a senator or a representative, I can't remember. He then really, you know, from everything he learned from this process, is now very interested in the adoption of foster children, and I think we will see some things coming from him to try to have an impact. But the adoption code rewrite is frankly not very relevant to y'all. Okay, questions. So how are we going to do this, Nicole?
Okay, so I have a few I'm going to read off to you, and then we have gotten
quite a lot of questions. So if your question does not get answered, Lila, if you're okay with this,
absolutely. I will submit all of them to Lila and get her to answer them, and then we'll send those out to everybody. So if you don't hear your question or if you have another one, go ahead and text it into us and we'll be sure to pass those on. Okay, can respite parents attend permanency hearings? We do have some respite people.
Yeah. Juvenile court hearings are open by default. Anybody can go. Your next door neighbor can go. The guy on the street can go. The judge can also close the court. And so the answer is yes, the respite parents can go. And then the judge would have the same option if the courtroom gets too busy or if a parent, for instance, stands up and says, I want everybody gone because this is private information. The judge can exclude people.
Okay, you talked about the citizen review panel. Can you explain a little bit about what that is? Are they held in every county?
They're not held in every county. What the code did, this came into place about 20 years ago, and it remained in the code revision. The individual courts have the option of having a volunteer community panel, a citizen panel, to conduct some of the reviews of the case. And so some courts have got very active citizen panels and they use them very well, other courts don't. If the court is using the citizen panel, then the job is to review the case and make recommendations to the court. They have no power. Some judges listen closely to what the citizen panel says. Some judges never read the reports at all.
All right, what is the primary purpose of the periodic review hearings, and do foster parents receive any documentation from these hearings?
Okay, no, you will not receive any documentation. You are not a party to the case. The purpose of the review, again, is to keep everybody on track. You know, it's what I was talking about, that people work on deadlines, and if you don't have any deadlines, you tend to let the cases languish. And especially, you know, my guess is for your kids, you're keeping them safe and stable, so your cases aren't on fire. You know, the DFACS workers are gonna spend their time and attention on the homes that are disrupting, on the kids that are, you know, getting expelled from school, on the parents who are, getting arrested and all of that. And so if you've got a more stable case, it's gonna fall to the bottom of the pile. And so when a court review hearing comes up, then people start paying attention again. They have to go into court. DFACS has to make a report. The child attorney is supposed to, you know, advocate for the best, you know, for what the child needs. And DFACS has to report what it's been doing so that the judge can try to keep them on track. That's the purpose of the review hearings. But no, foster parents would not get any reports back. You should not walk out of that court hearing with any paperwork because it's not your case.
All right. You may have touched on this because this question came in earlier, but how does the state weigh the pros and cons of placement with a relative versus placement with foster parents?
Yeah, it's hard. It is so hard. It's all those best interest factors combined with their evaluation of the relative, because they've got to determine that the relative is fit. So let me get into the weeds a little bit on this decision, on this question. If the child is not yet in care, okay? So DFACS comes into that home to investigate the reports of maltreatment or neglect. And they say to the parents, you know what? You clearly are not taking care of this child right now. I'm thinking we've got to do something to protect this child. It might be foster care, or if you've got a relative you can send this kid to, you have that right because you are the parent. I mean, think about your own situation. If you got in a car wreck and were laid up in the hospital and your kid's at home, you
probably have someone that you can tell the nurse at the hospital, call my mother, call my best friend to go pick my kid up from school, and your kid's going to be taken care of, and the state never gets involved. Or maybe you live far, you just moved here, and you live far away from your relatives, and so when you end up in the hospital, not able to pick your kid up from school, you have to say, please ask DFACS to go pick up my kid from school, because I don't know anybody, I just moved here. They're going to pick that kid up, and they're going to come to you, and they're going to say, who do you want us to give him to? And you're going to say, my mother, she lives in Savannah, she'll be here in 3 hours. Then DFACS will hold the kid until your mother gets here. Everything looks okay. There's no allegations of maltreatment. They're going to give the kid to your mother. But if they came in and see that you're strung out on drugs, and that's why they're going to have to take the kid away from you, and you say, my mother lives right next door, and they go meet your mother, then they've got to really weigh and make that in-the-moment decision based on their best judgment, your professional experience of whether to give that kid to your mother or not. Once the kid comes into care, let's say they decided, you know, grandma just doesn't look quite right to me, I'm going to go ahead and take this kid into care. Then they go to court, they get the permission to take the kid, they put the kid in foster care, and grandma's still there saying, me, 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 me. Or maybe there were no relatives before removal, but now they're doing the interviews and they find grandma or auntie or fictive kin, you know, godmother out there. Their obligation under law and policy is to check those people out. And if they are fit and willing, and the child wants to go and the parent wants them to go, then that's where the child should go. If the child wants to go and the parent does not want them to go, that gets taken into account, and they got a decision made. If the child does not want to go, the parent does, or the parent does not, and all of those factors get taken into account, and it's a hard decision.
Okay, we'll do one more question, and then, like I said, any other ones that haven't been answered, we'll make sure it's sent to Adam. Can you talk about sit-in judges? Is it recommended to ask for a continuation in this situation?
Depends on what kind of hearing you have. So yeah, under the code, the courts are supposed to have one judge assigned to a case from beginning to end. And from my experience, most of the courts take that very seriously and try to make that happen. But judges go on vacation, and judges get sick or have to go to conferences. And so if there's a court hearing scheduled, and in your case, and that judge is out sick or on vacation, then there's going to be a sit-in judge, a pro tem judge. It's not an easy question. If there's going to be a serious, life-changing decision to be made for that child, then almost everybody's going to want a continuance, and I think that's the best thing. I think the judge who knows that case should be the one making decisions to move a child, to reunify, you know, and such. If it's just a review hearing, I think it's better, personally, to go ahead and get into court. Everybody showed up anyway, or they had it on their calendar, because the judge can still hear all that, and a lot of times those review hearings, that's the value in just getting things done and checking in on everybody. So it's, it's a yes or no. All right, it's a lot. My contact information is on the handout. My cards are over there. As I said, for me and Lynn, this is where our hearts are. And so we love talking to foster parents about your cases. I'm willing to, to take calls or your emails and try to get in the weeds. Be prepared if you call me, I may give you a real strong reality check. I'm not always going to agree with you. Some people can take that, for me, but I don't cushion it when I'm talking to you about these cases. Sometimes I have connections in your courts and I can tell you who to talk to. Sometimes I've never stepped foot in that court before, and so I just don't know. I admire all of y'all for what you're doing, and thank you, and thanks for listening.
all the questions you guys submitted. Okay, so a few little housekeeping things. Lunch is going to be next. So what you're going to do is go out the door right here and take an immediate left. Rather than lead you through the church, we're going to send you outside through the back of the church where lunch will be. So there will be staff people directing you the right way. Honey baked ham is for lunch, and if you need a vegetarian or gluten-free option, when you go in the hallway, they're going to be on the left. Otherwise, there's going to be several options in the middle. Just grab a lunch. We have separated tables based on county. So if you want to find your county, that way you can meet some people that live around you, so you can eat with them during lunch. And then 10 minutes before it's time to go into the attic and start our COVID experience, you will see up on the TVs, there will be a countdown clock. So that will be your indication that lunch is almost done. Anything else? Oh yes, so when you go into the room, when lunch is finished, you're gonna see chairs you're gonna want to fill in from the front of the room back. So when you go in, don't be shy, just go ahead and go forward. Chairs are in different little clusters, so just pick where you want to be, but do not touch anything. There will be instructions from the code presenter on the folders that you'll see under the chair, but please do not start looking through those when you go in. Specific instructions. Okay, so I'm going to pray real quick for lunch, and then we'll head out. Dear God, thank you so much for this time. Again, just thank you so much for everybody here. I pray this food that we're about to receive will nourish our bodies. Thank you for the people who prepared it. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Amen.